I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Moorhead's monthly Current Science Forum series presents expert speakers and lively discussions of today's science headlines. Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center is online at moorheadplanetarium.org. And last but not least, thanks to personal contributions from the faculty, Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Biomanufacturing Research Institute and Technology Enterprise, or BRITE, at North Carolina Central University. BRITE is one of the newest and most innovative biotechnology educational initiatives in the country, and the only formal biotech degree program offered by a North Carolina university. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. As you just heard, we are indeed proud to have the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, or NESENT, as an underwriter of Radio In Vivo. Regular listeners will know that we often feature their scholars here on the show, and this week it is my particular honor to welcome the new director of NESENT, Dr. Alan Rodrigo, who in February took over the reins from Kathleen Smith, who had been the director of NESENT since 2005, and who was one of my early guests on Radio In Vivo in 2006. She continues her faculty position in the biology department at Duke, and Alan will have a joint faculty appointment there as well. Alan comes to Durham all the way from New Zealand. He was director of the Bioinformatics Institute at the University of Auckland from 2003 to 2009. He received both his bachelor's degree and his PhD in zoology from the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. He joins NESENT at a very exciting time when the center has just announced that they have received a five-year, $25 million renewal of their major grant from the National Science Foundation, which will fund continuation of the center's core programs in evolution research, informatics, and education through 2014. That brings the total contribution by NSF to $40 million. Alan, welcome to the U.S., and welcome to NESENT, and welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start our discussion today, Alan, by reacquainting our listeners a bit with the remarkable institution that is NESENT. Would you give us just a quick overview of what NESENT is and what it's been able to accomplish in its 6 years of existence?
So NESENT is funded to make sure that we have a platform, a facility for evolutionary scientists in the U.S. and worldwide to come together, share ideas, develop new ways of thinking about biological data, and in fact data that has an evolutionary bent. develop new ways of thinking about this and develop new knowledge. Nesant is not there to actually generate the data itself, because the NSF a long while ago realized that we're actually rich in terms of data that we have. What we need are new ways of thinking about the data that's out there, and that's Nesant's role. In particular, we are very concerned about how we analyze data that has some relevance in terms of evolution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for a long while, evolutionary science was focusing on biology. So we want to know how viruses evolve. We want to know how organisms are related to each other and how organisms evolve. But now people are thinking about how society evolves. People are thinking about how culture evolves. People are thinking about how computer programs evolve.
Mm-hmm.
So evolution has broadened its scope beyond biology to the social institutions, to institutions in medicine. And so Nesant is at the forefront of that. We are trying to encourage people to think broadly across all of these areas where there is natural change and adaptation.
I see. So thus the synthesis part of the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center.
Absolutely. And synthesis, if you think about the word, has its origins in terms of how we think about creation. So we're creating new information, creating new knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But also there's this notion, sort of a dialectic notion, that we're taking thesis, antithesis, and we're trying to come together with some form of synthesis.
Sure.
So we have competing views, and the hope is that Nesant facilitates coming together with an overview from these computing views.
I see. So in the nuts and bolts, how does that lofty mission translate into what goes on at the center every day?
So what Nesant does is it actually supports several programs to try to bring together these ideas and these concepts. So we have an in-house scholar program. We have postdoctoral fellows that sit at the center and actually do the exciting science. Sabbatical visitors, established scholars who visit the center for 6 months or so, or a year. And then we also support working groups. Now, these working groups are groups that have identified a particular area, an area that requires synthesis, and they visit the center frequently. So they may visit it twice, three times over the course of 2 years. And at the center, they are provided with resources, computational resources, etc., to develop their ideas. And the products might be something as simple as a publication that says, look, we've got a new way of thinking about this. These are some of the concepts. These are some of the ways of doing things. Or it could be something like a database. We've brought together all of this data. It's out there for all of you to use. So now here, go away and start thinking about how you want to address these questions. Other types of programs that we do, we have what we call catalysis meetings. Mm-hmm. And catalysis meetings really are the nuts and bolts of blue skies research. With catalysis meetings, people have no idea about the precise form of the questions, but they know it's an exciting area.
Right.
So a recent catalysis meeting that was held last year was one by David Sloan Wilson and his colleagues, where they were looking at behavioral economics. And they were saying, you know, if you think about economics, it's one of these situations where there's crowd behavior, ideas and spending behavior going on in a kind of a chaotic situation, and yet somehow it's driven by environmental conditions. And it sounds like the kind of thing that evolutionary biologists would be able to contribute to. So the group brought together evolutionary biologists and economics faculty to talk about ways that biology and economics can work together to address this chaotic behavior, apparent chaotic behavior of markets.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's exactly the kind of thing that we like to see.
Sure. Well, I know the catalysis meetings are one of the main functions of Nesant, and I've had the pleasure of attending a couple of them in the past, one of which was had to do with the application of evolutionary biology and thinking in evolutionary biology to medicine.
Right, absolutely.
And it was just fascinating and really amazing.
Absolutely.
How it all came together. And very much, not to use a worn-out cliche, but very much outside the box.
Right. And in fact, this you bring up a very nice example here, because frequently from these catalysis meetings will follow through other meetings, such as working groups, etc. So the evolutionary medicine meeting, there's going to be a follow-up meeting back in New Zealand, it turns out, which looks at the exact form of the research that we can do in evolutionary medicine. So it's one of these, you know, one of the exciting things of our mission is that we bring scientists together, and at the end of it, they go away, think about the problems, and then come back to us and say, now, you know, we've formulated some of these problems. Here's what we think we'd like to do. So apart from those meetings that we do at Nescent, another area that we are very, very interested in, and in fact, your program is an example of this, we want to make sure that we reach out to the public, to students, high school students, university students. We want to reach out and make sure that they know how evolution works in mm-hmm. terms of our understanding of day-to-day things. How is it that organisms cope? How do organisms cope in a changing climatic environment? What's going to happen when our ice shelves start retreating?
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen to communities, and how are they going to adapt to these things? In New Zealand, it's interesting because, of course, in New Zealand, we're looking forward to a more tropical climate.
Right.
Given our position, so you know we're looking
bring global warming on.
In fact, one of our the mayor of one of our cities in our southernmost city said, you know, every day he goes in during winter and prays for global warming.
Oh wow!
but the idea, but one of the serious consequences that we're facing is that we're typically free from pests and invasive insects, etc. But now we can see where that line is going to change, and we are expecting that more and more of our southern latitudes are going to have mosquitoes that we don't typically have, except in the north, and you know, all the attendant diseases that come with that. So, you know, there is a great deal of things that we'd like to let the public know about in terms of the programs that we do.
Sure. Well, and it's certainly important to communicate with the public the types of things that go on at Nescent and the broader concepts mm-hmm. that are emerging, particularly in our society right now today. That leads me to one of the questions I wanted to ask you, and I don't want to necessarily dwell on this too mm-hmm. much, but it's a pretty obvious question. Do you think Nescent is helping to win the battle for rational thinking in our culture when it comes to the question of evolution? Or more broadly, is that, do you think that battle is being won, or is broad acceptance of evolutionary theory really still in trouble outside the scientific community?
That's a good question, and you know, it's a question that I'm still coming to terms with, having moved from New Zealand to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
In New Zealand, we don't have difficult a task, I think, dealing with evolution and its outlook or its perception in the public eye. Coming to the U.S., I know that there are challenges here that the scientific community needs to address. And one of the issues that is facing me is the extent to which Nescent plays a active role in this debate or this discussion versus a role where it tries to foster an understanding or an environment in which understanding can be developed. Mm-hmm. So to give you an example, in New Zealand, we have different challenges that we face. So to give you an example, in New Zealand, we had a challenge of genetic modification.
Okay.
So there was a huge public response to genetic modification, to the point that the government basically said, all right, we're going to put a moratorium on all genetic modification. Now, at that point, there was a clear choice for universities in New Zealand to think about how we would approach public perception of genetic modification. And unfortunately, I felt the universities took the wrong approach. They stood up and said, we strongly support genetic modification, instead of saying, we're here to provide information to the public. We are happy to engage in discussion because our role as a university is as a conscience and critic of a policy.
Sure.
And so that is how I actually feel that NESNT needs to take a role. It needs to see itself as providing the opportunity for dialogue in whatever form that dialogue should take. And so at NESNT, what we want is we want our scientists not to shy away from these debates, but rather to form a framework, to deliver a framework where the public feel comfortable coming to us and saying, what do you think about this?
Mm-hmm.
And we can give them informed scientific views about evolution. So I actually think that that would be where I would like to see us, see our role in society.
I see. So do you see the role of NESNT evolving, so to speak, into a more outreach into the community and things of that nature? I know that it's been active in that from its inception.
Right. And so we'll continue to do that. So you know that we have a program. We have Darwin Day that we run with the North Carolina museums. We want to take that broader. So we want to take that nationally. Precisely for this idea that, and we also engage with teachers nationally as well. So I think letting people feel comfortable that they can contact the NESNT scientist, they can contact myself or Robin, our communications manager, and say, look, what are your views on this? You know, what does NESNT think about this? Do you have any views on this? I think that would be a good thing. I think, you know, if there are issues that come up in terms of human evolution that people would like more information about, well, we're there to provide that kind of information.
Okay, well, you actually led in directly into the next question I had for you, and that is about human evolution itself. I know that one of the major questions that crops up from time to time in this arena is one that NESNT programs have addressed frequently over the past few years, and that is, are human beings, in fact, evolving? If so, in what way and how quickly?
That's a very, very, very good question. And in fact, it's a controversial question. Some people have said we've stopped evolving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've stopped evolving in the sense that our genetic makeup is not changing and the way we look is not changing. But what's happening is that culture has taken over. The ability of culture and the ability of our social institutions to actually have wrap around us an outer skin, as it were, and it is that outer skin that evolves. Other people are saying, well, you know, that's not true. You know, we can look at our genes and we can show that the genetic makeup has changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
What we can say, I think, and this controversy is not going to be settled in the next year or so.
Sure.
It's gonna take a while. But what we can say, I think, is that regardless of what has happened, the rate of change in our environment, and this is induced partly because of humans, we have made that change, and we have made that change has happened quickly because of us. That rate of change is such that if there are biological changes that are taking place in humans, it is not taking place at a rate that's fast enough to cope with the rate of change that is happening in our environment. I think that is a safe statement to make.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is there is a mismatch. And in fact, this has come to be known as the mismatch theory. There is a mismatch between what we are as genetic individuals, as biological individuals, and what we have to be as individuals that live in a particular environment.
Sure.
Now, can we catch up with that? Or do we now alter our environment so that we slow the pace down? So one of the suggestions, for instance, has been to alter our dietary habits, right? Our nutrition.
Right, right.
Because, of course, that's tied in to our physiological makeup, our biological makeup.
So we're not hunter-gatherers anymore.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. I mean, people can see that. Another actually exciting idea is the idea that psychologically, we're not used to living in big cities, right? And so perhaps one way of thinking about a lot of the psychological syndromes that we have is that it is a consequence of our lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
maybe we should be thinking about smaller groups, suburban groups, subdivisions. I know that you have a lot of subdivisions. I've just moved into one yesterday.
Ah, there you go.
And maybe that's the right way of thinking about how humans should live. But these are the kinds of questions that are going on. And you know, the challenge for us, of course, is that as scientists, we may suggest what is an appropriate way of living, but that's no guarantee that that is ever going to become a politically appropriate way of doing things.
Sure. Well, and you talk about the mismatch, and just to clarify that, it's really in evolutionary terms, you know, we're talking not quite geological terms, but it's still quite a long time span.
Absolutely.
That we talk about. And evolutionary changes don't happen overnight, except to viruses and things
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, and that's exactly right. And the human population needs time to readjust, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can look on the other side of the coin, and this is the side of the coin where people say, you know, we've stopped evolving biologically because the cornerstone of evolution is reproduction. You know, if you can produce more of your genetic makeup, that's great. Now, we've extended lifespans. We've extended the age of reproductive processes. And we've done this artificially, right?
So
people are able to reproduce, even if they may not be able to naturally. And so now we've changed the framework within which evolution can work. And so there is that to think about as well. That complexity plays into the fact that, you know, we may not need to evolve in terms of our physical makeup, in terms of the way we change, because we've got all of this technology that's, as I said, wrapped itself around us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's leading us to increase our fitness, increase our longevity, increase our reproductive success.
And it seems like that process is, in fact, accelerating.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so you can't... I think it is totally right and appropriate for us to say that we as humans have a responsibility to make sure that our fellow humans live as long as they can, are given the best health, and give us the best treatment. And so what this does is it immediately says, look, we don't want to play Mother Nature's game. We don't want to play the game of survival for the fittest, because mm-hmm. as humans, that is ethically abhorrent to us.
Sure.
And so in a sense, evolution becomes no longer something that we do, that we think of as something to be supported when it comes to human populations, but in fact, something to control.
Mm-hmm. What about as medicine evolves, Alan, and we get into things like gene therapy and the ability to actually address
right.
some of these issues? And maybe, you know, maybe that's still in its infancy, but maybe in 100 years it becomes commonplace, which in evolutionary terms is a blink of an eye. Do you think that there's a future out there where the human race would have the power to basically control its own evolution?
So that's you know, we're getting into Brave New World territory.
Yes, we are.
Territory. and, you know, It's fun to speculate, and I'm an optimist when it comes to the human condition, and I think that we will prevail. I think the challenges facing us now are less in the domain of health and more in the domain of the environment. To be perfectly honest,
mm-hmm.
I think we've got health is continuing. I mean, the obesity epidemic, diabetes, etc., that whole syndrome
sure.
is an issue, but I worry more about the environment than I do about our medical the medical promise. I think medically we are on track, but you don't want to get to the point where you've taken care of people, you've increased their life expectancy to 90, 100. But the environment in which they live in, the quality of life is awful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there has to be some, I think we have to think about the environment consciously, because it may well be that that's what's going to be the telling feature in terms of how our humans actually exist in the next generation. It would be hard to imagine our children growing up in overcrowded, highly dense, polluted places.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if they do live to be 100, it would not be a quality of life that we would want to place on them.
Sure. So what role might evolutionary biology play in improving and or protecting the environment as we move forward?
Well, I think it's more a case of delivering some mechanism to understand what will happen. As I said, one of the issues, for instance, is how will pests invade? How will pests invade these environments as climate changes? How will viruses adapt? How will pathogens adapt in terms of being able to cross over in species? Because remember, one of the things that happens with climate change, of course, is that your livable surface can actually shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're bringing animals into contact with humans. And so there's more and more opportunity for animals, viruses from one animal species to cross over into another, into humans.
Sure.
We've seen that quite a bit.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And, you have to start to think about those kinds of things. And certainly evolutionary science is geared towards providing the kinds of tools that we can use to model them. The emergence of new diseases, how these diseases cross over the species boundaries, are the sorts of things that we tackle as evolutionary scientists, and in fact are being tackled at NSENT as well.
Absolutely. Well, I know that that's speaking directly to your own mm-hmm. research work, and I want to spend a good bit of time on it, but not just yet. Mm-hmm. We'll talk a little bit more about what's going on at NSENT first. Another major activity, Alan, I know that goes on with several of the scholars at NSENT, is work on the so-called Tree of Life. Tell us a little bit about some of the strides that NSENT people have made in that arena and why that is so important.
Right. So Tree of Life is a fascinating idea that, it harks back, of course, to Darwin's time and pre-Darwinian times as well. The idea that we all share a common ancestry and a common lineage that can be expressed as a tree.
Sure.
And a tree is nothing more than a branching diagram. We're all familiar with family trees.
Mm-hmm.
So here we're thinking about family trees of organisms. So the idea that we can collect everything on Earth, every species on Earth, and somehow represent it on this huge family tree is of great interest to biologists. It's the equivalent, I guess, of looking at planets and stars and saying that if we could find a common origin, some framework in which to understand all of these things, then this is exactly what astronomers would want to do as well.
Sure, sure.
So from now, you can imagine the challenge. The challenge is we've got lots and lots and lots of species, right? So if there's a famous saying, that God loves beetles, so there are 300,000 beetles. So just even if we just thought about beetles alone, you've got 300,000 species of beetles. So imagine mm-hmm. trying to have a family tree of 300,000 relatives, uncles, aunts, nieces, cousins, etc. You just won't be able to do it.
Right.
So but it is nonetheless a goal of biology to try to assemble all species on Earth into this family tree. So what does NSENT do? Well, one of the things that we're doing, and we've actually just released another version of the software for this, is we're collecting all of the trees that people have done for little groups of organisms that have been published in scientific papers.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that now you can go to this database and you can find any given organism and you can say, what have people written about this? and pull out a little subset of that tree. So that collects in one place. It doesn't collect the whole tree, but it does collect parts of the tree, to make it accessible to people. The other area that's of interest, of course, is how do we develop the tools to actually come up with this huge tree? And that's an area of research that has challenged computational biologists for the longest time. And it's only now that we have good computing resources that it's starting to become tractable, that we're starting to be able to say, we think we know how to do it.
Okay.
And that's by taking lots of these small trees and putting them into a larger picture. So much like you would take, the family tree from one part of your family and from another part of the family and try to draw the connecting lines, as it were. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what we're doing with these very, very large trees.
And already in that work, there's been quite a few surprises that have emerged in terms of the relationships. I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, the term is phylogenetic.
Correct.
That have been seen from some of that work.
Correct. And so it's not surprising because, dating back, one of the first surprises that actually happened back when we had, were first starting out in terms of looking at using genetic markers to actually reconstruct parts of these trees. Something that happened in 1994. I recall reading this because I was working on a group at the time, a particular part of the tree at the time. I was working on sponges, which are of course very primitive animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading the publication in Science, and it claimed to show that mushrooms, fungi, are more closely related to animals than they are to plants. Now, of course, you don't think of that, right? When you're out there eating your spaghetti with mushrooms, and you're a vegetarian, then that's
so you may have to rethink that.
but it was fascinating at the time, and in fact, now we know that that's the case. We know that fungi are generally more closely related to animals than they are to plants. So this is a surprise that came up way back when.
Sure.
And there have been those kinds of surprises that have emerged over the course of building these trees, this tree of life.
Yeah, it's a fascinating enterprise.
Absolutely.
That I know is going to continue at Nesent and elsewhere. My guest on Radio en Vivo today is Dr. Alan Rodrigo, director of the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. Alan, obviously, Nesent must be a very exciting place to be right now. How did it come about that you came to get the director's job? How did you come to Nesent?
Right. And so I was at the university. I was here actually in the U.S., first at Stanford and then in University of Washington for about 5 years before I returned to New Zealand. I'm from New Zealand originally, and I went back and I was in New Zealand for 10 years where I established the Bioinformatics Institute there, established a program in undergraduate program in bioinformatics and later a graduate program in bioinformatics. And at the end of that time, I felt that, I'd got to know as much of my university as I needed to know, and I enjoyed it there. And the opportunity came up for this directorship, and I had already heard of Nesent because of its activities. I was very excited by what it was doing.
You hadn't visited previously, though.
I had not visited previously. No, that's right. I was very excited by what it could do. I had colleagues who had visited Nesent, and so I applied, and I was fortunate enough and lucky enough to get the position. And I must say that since I've been here 2 months, my initial impression of what Nesent was has not changed. In fact, it's got better. The science is exciting. The people at Nesent are doing extremely exciting work, and the caliber of our scholars who are there are phenomenal. So, you know, I've visited institutions all around the world. I've been at the Isaac Newton Institute in Cambridge. I've been at Oxford, and I must say that, you know, the people that you have here are a match for any international scholar that you can think of.
Wow, and it's a wonderful physical facility.
Absolutely.
Also, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's in the old Irwin Mill.
That's right.
Over in Durham, and they did a terrific restoration job.
That's right. And you know, we have a sister synthesis center called NCES, which is the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis, and they're in Santa Barbara. And people love it because it's Santa Barbara, but people love coming to Nesant because they say, look at our facilities, and they say, you know, it's great.
Mm-hmm. And this time of year, all you have to do is take them over to Duke Gardens.
Absolutely. That's right.
Well, Alan, what is your vision for the future of Nesant? I know that you have bring some new ideas and new thinking to the table.
Right.
Tell us about that.
So obviously with my own background, one of the things that I'm very keen to see Nesant develop further is a strong international presence.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Nesant is well placed to actually participate internationally in a number of areas and to collaborate internationally. So we are already set to start establishing linkages with people with equivalent institutes in Canada. Of course, in New Zealand, because of my background there.
Sure.
In Australia. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the areas that we'll be pursuing actively. So that might involve supporting joint programs, joint scholars, and the like. The other area that I'm very excited about is an area we've just introduced this year called the Nesant Ambassador Program. And that's an area where we intend to send a Nesant ambassador, someone who will go to an underdeveloped country where there are resident scientists there who may not have the technical expertise to analyze the rich collection of data that they may have available.
Mm-hmm.
So these are scientists who are very aware of the challenges they face, but may not have either the financial resources or the ability to travel out of the country to actually get assistance with that. So one of the things we want to do is send someone for a period of time, 2 months, 3 months, establish a post there where they help these scientists with the analysis of the data, run some workshops. And at the end of it, the hope is that what we would have done is trained up maybe two or three scientists sufficiently well so that they can then train their resident community there.
Mm-hmm.
So we are looking at several places. We have a contact who has a training facility in Africa. We also have contacts who have training facilities in South America and in Southeast Asia as well. So, you know, we're quite excited about this because, as I said, with our outreach program, one of the things that we want to do is we want to be able to tell people about evolution and how evolutionary analyses can be used.
Sure. Well, that does sound very exciting. Wish you the best of luck with that.
Thank you.
As it develops. Alan, what has the renewal of the NSF funding meant in terms of your ability to implement programs like the one you just described and kind of, you know, recatalyze the synthesis center, as
right,
it were?
Right. So I should say that before I took the job, I actually came here for a visit, and Kathleen and I, Kathleen, as you say, was the director then,
mm-hmm.
Went up to NSF for a visit, and we talked to NSF about some of these ideas that we had, and they were extremely receptive and very, very supportive of all of the ideas of mm-hmm. establishing linkages overseas with people overseas. Getting community buy-in from here about our programs, etc. So I'm very, very comfortable with NSF and what they've said they'd like to see, because it perfectly fits in line with what I, as someone who's come from overseas and envisaged a director would like to also see.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In fact, so we're actually on Monday, we're visiting NSF to talk more about some of these some of these opportunities as well.
Terrific. Well, they must be just tickled with what has gone on in the last 5 or 6 years since the establishment of the center itself.
Absolutely. They were very, very impressed with... So the thing that they really were impressed about with the center, and they've told us this on a few occasions, is our responsiveness to what the community wants. So a synthesis center cannot be a stagnant entity. Evolutionary science, if it's meant to be at the forefront, develops, as sure. all sciences do. And so we cannot just run the same programs. There'll always have to be certain twists and certain types of things that you develop. And so NSF was very, very pleased with how, under Kathleen and under the previous director, Cliff, that you know, we had these programs that were responsive to what people wanted.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So it gives a sense of stability, I'm
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Well, Alan, will you be able to continue with your own research pursuits as you pursue this job, or have you had to kind of put that on the back burner?
No. So, in fact, I have, with my appointment at Duke as well, a joint appointment as a professor of biology at Duke, I have a lab there.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my lab, I'm a computational biologist, which means that my lab is a dry lab. So it's full of computers.
Right.
And computer programmers who seem to live on pizza and Coke. But, you know, that's another story.
Right.
And my research is on the development of new methods to study evolution. And, you know, you've mentioned viruses. Of course, that's a big area of my research as well.
Right.
And recently, one of the areas that I've become interested in is looking at bioinformatics methods to study clinical prediction, to make clinical predictions as well.
Mm-hmm. That's, I think, going to be a richly emerging field
Absolutely.
In
Absolutely.
The next several years.
Absolutely.
I was at a talk yesterday, a gentleman from the Genome Institute,
yes.
who was addressing that very point, and got some just fascinating trials going on already.
That's right. That's
applying
right.
bioinformatic methods.
And in fact, one of my PhD students, who's still back in New Zealand, just submitted his dissertation yesterday. Was working on a huge on analyses to look at clinical predictions. Clinical data from women who are pregnant for the first time. And we're looking at the diseases associated with first-time pregnancy, including high blood pressure and spontaneous growth, you know, where you have fetal growth restrictions, premature babies, etc.
Sure, sure.
And it was a really interesting project. A large number of women enrolled, looking at a range of different clinical markers, and the bioinformatics tools that we developed seem to work reasonably well in terms of being able to make these kinds of predictions of outcome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, bioinformatics, we should probably, before we dig too much deeper into it, we've mentioned it several times already, we probably ought to kind of provide our listeners with a little bit of a definition of what that is.
Right. So I have a kind of a stock phrase that I use. I always say that bioinformatics is the computational organization and analysis of biological data. So what does this mean? I've made the point that we're in a climate now where there's a lot of biological data. And this is not just genetic data.
Mm-hmm.
It's data about where things are, what kind of climates they're used to, what they look like, etc.
Sure.
So biological data in its entirety. So if you imagine having all of that data and imagine trying to make sense of it, you need two things. You first of all need to organize it, so computational organization,
mm-hmm.
and you need computers to organize it, so you need to store it somewhere that other people can get access to. And then you need to analyze it. So if you think of that data and you somehow want to convert it to information and you want to convert information to knowledge, you kind of need to massage the data and look for trends, look for how things happen. So that's what bioinformatics
is.
Exactly.
Like
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what bioinformatics is, computational sure. organization and analysis of data.
Okay, well, it's just an amazing field, and it's been interesting from my perspective over the last 10 years or so to watch the trends, because when I kind of started being a science writer, there was a real gap, mm-hmm. a major gap between the computational firepower
right.
and bioinformatics
right.
tools that were
right.
be able to brought to bear on these mountains of
That's
data
right.
that were emerging, that the people on the bench were being able to, you know, with increasing automation
mm-hmm.
and high throughput capabilities, you know, they were generating these reams and reams and reams
right.
of data, and the tools weren't quite ready
That's right.
for all that. But uh-huh. it appears, from my perspective, that that gap has narrowed, and the bioinformatics has really started catching up, and it seems like there's almost a critical mass just in the last couple of years.
Yeah, and you see, what actually it's a little deceptive, because to be honest, what's happened is less that the tools are catching up, as more that the lab, the experimental biologists have realized that they need a computational biologist sitting in the lab.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So in other words, mm-hmm. what's happened is, as they're collecting the data, there's become a growing realization, and it's become a flood. And now we know that you cannot collect data without having talked to someone who can analyze that data on mm-hmm. a computer.
Sure.
And so the programs that we have are still, a lot of them are still very primitive. It's just that somebody else there is sitting and doing the work who knows how to use the program. So you actually have this. So, you know, I would advise any of your young listeners who are listening that bioinformatics and computational biology is a great career path
mm-hmm.
right now. And it's not going to go away.
I have been saying that for years. It's not plastics anymore like in the old days. It's bioinformatics.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I have actually given that advice from my lay perspective.
That's great.
It's a field that's going to be burgeoning.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
High demand.
Absolutely. And, yeah. you know, so I mentioned that we started a course in Auckland on bioinformatics.
Mm-hmm.
And the trend before that point was to take a computer scientist and give them as much biology as felt was needed so that they could call themselves a bioinformaticist. And, or take a biologist and give them a few tools, computer tools, that they could then use to analyze their data. What we did was we engineered the course from the ground up. So we told all our students they had to take mathematics, statistics, computer science, and biology.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 40 enrolled in the first year. And in the last year, there were 10. There was a huge attrition rate of students that dropped out. But the 10 that stayed were really good,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
excellent students. And the biggest difficulty that when we used to speak to the students, what was your biggest challenge with the course, was actually attending a biology lecture and then having to go to a math lecture and completely change the way you think about things.
Interesting.
It, mm-hmm. And it is interesting. It is one of these challenges that I find. And, you know, so computational biologists are a rare breed because they are able to think mathematically and biologically. And there's enough fuzziness in biology that it always frustrates a true blue computer scientist. But a computational biologist can deal with that.
Right. Well, so it takes a special kind of person.
It does.
Interesting, interesting. Alan, tell us a little bit more about your research, mm-hmm. Particularly your work with rapidly evolving pathogens.
That's right. Yeah.
I know you've worked on HIV and SARS and mm-hmm. influenza. Tell us a little bit more mm-hmm. about some of the work you've done.
So that work actually started after my postdoctoral work at Auckland. So I started it when I was at Stanford, and it was with Jim Mullins, who was based there at the time. And it was looking at the molecular evolution of HIV. So Jim was was a person who studied rapidly evolving viruses. These are retroviruses that have an enzyme that doesn't replicate very well. So it has errors in the way it replicates the genome of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim started looking at HIV way back when it was first observed in the U.S. population. And I joined him at Stanford in 1994, and we were looking at the evolution of HIV. And that work continued until today. So initially, it was actually looking at how HIV evolves. So if you think about a virus that evolves rapidly, that virus exists in your in your body. And because it evolves rapidly, each individual virus is slightly different from each other individual virus that's in your body.
Okay.
So it's like a population of things that we are used to thinking about, population of humans, a population of elephants, whatever. It's diverse within the body. To the virus, the human body is like a world, right? In the same sense that it, in the way that it can, for instance, infect different parts of your body. Different parts of your body are like different continents, for instance. So it might infect the brain, or it might infect the liver, and it might infect the spleen. Each part will adapt slightly differently. Now, if you think about a virus in that way, if you think about HIV in that way, for instance, then you start to think, well, how does that evolution, how does it relate to what the body is doing? Well, what the body is doing is it's thinking of that virus as something to get rid of. So immediately, the virus is in a predator-prey situation, right? The immune system now is the predator. It's trying to get rid of the virus, and the virus is like the prey. And if you start to think about that, then you start to think, well, how can a virus escape if it's got a predator? Well, the way HIV escapes is to camouflage itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it changes the part of its structure that the immune system can recognize. And by doing that, it actually manages to persist in the host. Now, HIV is a bit interesting because the cells of the body that it infects is actually the immune system cells. So as it persists in the body, it actually is destroying your immune system to the point where it can no longer cope with the virus. So one of the challenges that we were interested in was trying to figure out the relationship between the evolution of the virus and how it compromised the immune system and how disease progressed. We have got some way towards doing this. We kind of know what are the signatures of virus evolution that tells us whether or not a person is going to live longer or whether a person is going to succumb to the disease in a shorter space of time. We know, for instance, that the virus is constantly being pummeled by the immune system, so that there's a lot of change in the virus. And I could see that change. I can monitor that change. It tells me that that person is likely to live a lot longer because it's got a strong immune system. If I take a virus from a person and I see very little change over time, I'm thinking to myself, that person doesn't have a very strong immune system. That person is probably not going to live a lot longer.
The predator is weak.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. That's right. And so there's some signatures that we can already see. Now, we've also seen some very startling things that we were not expecting with the virus. For instance, we like to think of evolution as accumulating some changes, moving through time. So you have changes, and even if these changes are reversals, there's still this notion that you're going to accumulate things. With HIV, one of the curious things that's happened is that if you take a virus from one individual and somehow move it into another individual, the virus reverts back to a wild type form and then starts to accumulate a whole lot of mutations that are unique for that individual.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because if you think about it, it makes sense. While it is in one individual, it is coping with the immune system of that individual. It does this by accumulating mutations, but it turns out that the mutations that it accumulates actually damages its ability to replicate. It can still replicate, but it doesn't replicate as well.
Okay.
So as soon as you take it out from that individual, the first thing it's going to try to do is lose all of those mutations that it's gained in that individual to try to increase its replication capacity. You put it into another one, it loses all of those, and now it acquires new mutations that confer resistance to the new individual that it's in. So this kind of moving back and then moving forward was, it's not unexpected in evolution. I mean, we know that that happens, but it was surprising nonetheless for HIV.
I can imagine that. That's hard to picture in a way, and that's a very smart virus.
Yeah. So, I mean, your listeners will know, of course, when I say that the virus is doing such and such. It's not actually, you know, cognitively.
Right, but it, sure, it almost sounds that way.
That's right. But it's just so happened
but that's why it's been so challenging to fight it as
correct.
Well, right?
Correct. And, you know, so one of the, we were involved in vaccine design as well. And one of the ways of designing a vaccine is to take something that's circulating in the population and say, I'm going to inject people with this in the hope that the next time the same virus comes along, your immune system is going to recognize that vaccine, that thing that you've injected.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with HIV, because of the diversity, you can't really do that. So what you have to do is, what we've done is we've developed a potential way of developing a vaccine which looks at the ancestor of the virus. Now, of course, the ancestor is no longer here.
Sure.
So this is where the computational biology comes in. We estimate what that ancestor is using computational tools.
Mm-hmm.
And then we take that genetic code for that ancestor. You take it to a lab and they make it in the lab.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite cool.
Yeah.
So when they make it in the lab, we've been able to show that actually, so we don't make the full virus, we make a part of it. We've been able to show that that part of it behaves like a normal virus would. Which means this is something you've estimated using a computer, a biological thing, and then you've put it in and it works like a real organism.
Wow.
Which mm-hmm. is really nice.
Yeah.
But what that does is it actually makes it more similar. The ancestral virus is slightly more similar to the things that are going around, that are circulating. And so because of that, we hope it'll be more protective. Now,
sure.
Whenever I talk about this, I always end my talk by saying that it's been as successful as any other vaccine out there. Because the sad truth about HIV is that no vaccines are successful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the ones we developed were no more successful as well.
Really? Well, it's still to be worked on then.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Alan, before we run out of time, I wanted to be sure to ask you about your accomplishments in the martial art known as Choi Kwong Do. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's right, yes.
So I understand that you're actually going to be teaching a course here and just achieved your black belt status.
Absolutely,
recently.
Absolutely, yes. In January of this year, I got a black belt in Choi Kwong Do, which is related to Taekwondo, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And its home land is in Atlanta. The headquarters of Choi Kwong Do is in Atlanta. And yeah, I'm teaching a course right now at Duke on that.
And does your work with that kind of inform your scientific pursuits?
No, it actually allows me to not think about science
okay.
for the hour that I'm actually doing the analysis. So that gets me refreshed for the next time I have to think about science.
Very good. Well, Alan, it's been a great pleasure and an honor to have you here on Radio In Vivo today, and certainly wish you the best of luck as you move forward with your leadership at NESENT.
Thank you very much. I truly appreciate it.
And we've got some wonderful guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows, which we update regularly as we book new appearances. And we are on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan. And you can stay up to date with the schedule on the Facebook page as well. So join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And we will catch you next time.